Thank you very much, Matt Gosher. Yes, I was saying before lunch that well, what a pleasure it is to be invited to speak here. And really nice to be in this space, wonderful to be in this space. And if you're new to this Buddhist Centre, well, a welcome from me as well. Before lunch, I was talking about quantum physics, amongst other things. I was talking about how Buddhism has, at least later Buddhism, has a notion that mind or consciousness or... I was careful not to define my terms, actually, because I don't really know how to. But mind is perhaps a more fundamental reality than matter. If we've got this this kind of tension or duality between mind and matter, then from a Buddhist perspective, it would be better to regard everything as of the nature of mind and matter being a manifestation of mind, rather than a scientific materialist notion where matter is the only real reality, atoms and particles of atoms are the only real reality, and that this notion of mind or consciousness is a sort of byproduct, an epiphenomenon of the fact that our brains are very, very complex neurological machines, biological machines. So that's a sort of scientific materialist perspective, that matter is all there is, that we are very complex biological machines, that at the end of our lives, at the end of when the body dies, that's it, there's no more. That is a scientific materialist notion. What I didn't really spell out, but I think it's true, is that that is a belief. It's a belief, yeah? It's not science. Science doesn't know what mind or consciousness is. Science doesn't know what happens when we die or doesn't happen when we die. Scientific materialism is a belief that is sometimes conflated with science. So physicists may or may not be scientific materialists. I'm told that there's a significant minority of physicists who regard themselves as religious or spiritual, and presumably they do believe that there's more than mere matter. So yes, in the first half of the this sort of session, in the first talk, I was talking about mind and the nature of mind. And I hope that I left some of you baffled. If you were here for that first talk, I hope that you left suitably confused. That's a bit of a get-out, I know. But quantum physics, which I was talking about, is beyond comprehension, beyond conceptual comprehension. What quantum physics is saying does not make sense to the rational mind. And the main thing I was trying to point out is that the best theory that we have ever come up with of matter is so paradoxical as to make some physicists question, whether there's an objective world out there at all. So this notion of objectivity of a really existent external world is undermined by quantum physics, at least by a common interpretation of quantum physics, because nobody really knows what quantum physics means. But realism, that's the sort of technical way of talking about this, realism is undermined by quantum physics. I was saying that there are interpretations of quantum physics that retain a belief in an objective world. There are realist interpretations. But if you are a realist and a quantum physicist, then you have to believe in something like an infinite number of universes, splitting every instant into infinite more universes, with you and me being infinitely represented in those parallel universes, but slightly different. So somewhere in an infinite number of universes, I'm still giving this talk, but I'll still have my hair, for example, and you might be younger than you are now, and there'll be other universes where that won't be the case, etc. Now that is the price that some physicists are willing to pay in order to maintain a realist position. Yeah? Certainly when I was studying physics about 30 years ago, the common interpretation, the most common popular interpretation of quantum physics wasn't a realist one. It was that we don't have an objective universe, that the world that we experience somehow comes into being through observation, through our knowing it, that we create the world. So that was what I was talking about earlier. And in a way, what I was trying to do was to make people see that we don't know what's going on. But we really don't know what's going on. We don't know what matter is. We don't know what space and time are. We don't know what energy is. We don't certainly know what consciousness is or mind is. That when it comes down to it, we know very, very little at all. And perhaps the most salient thing that we do know is that the world isn't as it appears to be. That the commonsensical notion of a real world out there that exists just as it appears to be is illusory. That's wrong. And so modern physics sort of shows that, it proves that. And I don't think we're ever going to go back from that. Even though physics might not have the ultimate answers, we're never going to go back to a common sense realism. So that's what I was trying to say. So in this talk, I want to look at least a model that comes from the Buddhist tradition of what is going on. What is going on? Yeah, and it is only a model that I'm going to talk about. We mustn't, of course, mistake the map for the terrain, etc., etc. So Buddhism uses models, it uses metaphors as ways of pointing to what is the nature of things. And it does that from a pragmatic basis. The Buddha wasn't a philosopher, he wasn't a scientist. In a certain sense, he didn't adopt any particular theory about what's going on, about the nature of reality. What the Buddha was concerned about was freeing us from suffering. And the premise of Buddhism is that we suffer unnecessarily because we don't understand, we don't see things the way they really are. We're living in a prison of our own making, as Einstein said, and that's because of a delusion. We've got something very, very wrong, not just at an intellectual level, but in our very guts, in our very instinct, in our very depths of our sort of being or non-being, we've got something very wrong. And that fundamental delusion can be summed up as believing that there's a real separate fixed entity called me, or in your case, you, in a real objective existing world. So there's a real separate fixed self or being in a real objective existing world. That's our common sense sort of mode of operating. There's a real me in a real world. And that is said to be the delusion that causes all the pain, all the problems. It causes all the self-centeredness, and then everything that arises from self-centeredness, from petty selfishness, which I'm not exempt from myself, to the horrors of man-made wars and disasters, even the environmental destruction that the planet is facing at human hands, is all down to us believing very, very, very trenchantly in a real me in a real world. And then we fight to maintain what I want, that the boundary between me and world. So I want to sort of park that Buddhist notion and move to a sort of more cosmic perspective to start looking at, in a way, how we might understand the nature of things, the nature of the universe. I want to start with some words from a childhood hero of mine, Carl Sagan, who was a cosmologist, astronomer, a physicist who was also, he seemed to have the heart of a poet. He was certainly a very inspiring figure. And as a young boy, I watched him on television give what were called the Christmas lectures. And they inspired me to want to find out more about what's going on, which then led me to, it led me to want to study physics. But more fortunately, it's led me to Buddhism. Anyway, Carl Sagan has this model where he, first of all, tries to get us to to find our place in the cosmos. The universe is said to be, if it started with the Big Bang, which looks like it probably did, although then that even that causes questions as to what happened before, etc., etc. But if it started with the Big Bang, that seems to be about 13.8 billion years ago. What Carl Sagan does is he gets us to imagine that cosmic history of 13.8 billion years shrunk down to 1 year. If it was 1 year that the cosmos has been going, then this is what it would look like. He calls it the cosmic calendar. So he says the cosmic calendar compresses the local history of the universe into a single year. If the universe began on January the 1st, it was not until May that the Milky Way formed. That's our galaxy, the Milky Way, in May. Other planetary systems may have appeared in June, July, and August, but our Sun and Earth, not until mid-September. Life arose soon after. We humans appear on the cosmic calendar so recently that our recorded history occupies only the last few seconds of the last minute of December the 31st. Then he goes on to say that we on Earth have just awakened to the great oceans of space and time from which we emerged. We are the legacy of 14 billion years of cosmic evolution. We have a choice. We can enhance life and come to know the universe that made us, or we can squander our 14 billion year heritage in meaningless self-destruction. What happens in the first second of the next cosmic year depends upon what we do here and now with our intelligence and our knowledge of the cosmos. So yes, Carl Sagan, in a way, he's putting us at that sort of pivotal point, which of course may not be a completely accurate way of looking at it. Although in my first talk, I was showing or trying to show or argue that somehow the universe, for its very, very existence, depends upon a conscious observer to bring it into existence. I won't recap that notion. But I find it really stirring to think about this vastness of space and time with us at this kind of, in a way, seemingly insignificant place in this, and yet somehow mind and consciousness being pivotal. So then I offer this model from Buddhism, from my teacher, Sangharakshita, as to what is going on. If there isn't a real me, a real fixed separate me, that is, a real, if self is a construct, and if the world out there is a construct, if that's not what's really going, what is going on? And what the Buddha taught was that, yes, there are no fixed entities. There are no fixed entities, no real fixed subjects, internal entities, or no fixed objects out there. That is a construct. To think in terms of subjects and objects in really existing space and time, all of that's a mental construct that we impose upon experience. What the Buddha taught was that you can, however, talk about some natural laws. It's not like there's, on the one hand, there's not nothing. It's not that there's nothing there. Something's happening. We do have experience. It does make sense to talk about our experience. There does seem to be, even if I say that there's no fixed and separate me, my experience doesn't probably seem to be the same as yours. Otherwise, we'd get very confused. So there does seem to be some order. Something's going on, and there does seem to be some order to it. It's not just disorder. It's not just chaos. There are galaxies and planetary systems and suns and planets like Earth. And then there does seem to be life. So what the Buddha taught is that although there are no fixed entities, there are natural laws that seem to govern how experience arises, how the world that we experience, how that seems to be arising. He talked in terms of conditions and laws that govern the arising of conditions. He envisaged, his enlightenment experience was in a way beyond all models and concepts. It was a flash of knowing, of seeing, that I can only imagine. I'm not enlightened, so I don't know what the Buddha experienced. But it's said that the enlightenment experience was beyond all concepts. But then when he tried to teach others what he'd seen, to try and get them to also experience what he'd experienced, he had to use concepts. And one of the first concepts that he used was that there are natural laws, and that there are these conditioned arisings. There aren't things, but there are, as it were, processes. And those processes arise and cease dependent on natural laws. So there are natural laws governing the arising of experience. In my first talk, I was making a point that I just think is worth repeating here, which is that mind or consciousness is intrinsically involved in the arising of those experiences. It's not like you might imagine systems theory, for example, to work, that there's a whole complex set of conditions and it's all objectively going on out there. Somehow consciousness is involved in whatever it is that's arising. But nevertheless, we can talk about the natural laws that seem to govern the unfolding of this experience at all levels, from the most seemingly personal experience to the whole evolution of the cosmos. Yeah, there seem to be natural laws. So Sangharakshita has drawn from the Buddhist tradition and identified different categories of natural laws. And there are five categories that he's talked about that do seem to come from the Buddhism, but he's put his own interpretation on them. And the Buddhist word, the Sanskrit word for law, in this sense of natural law, is niyama. Niyama. So there are five sets of niyamas, five categories of natural law that seem to be going on. And the laws of physics, which I was talking about earlier, quantum physics, but also the laws of relativity that govern space and time, the laws of thermodynamics, all the laws of physics, the natural laws that physics studies, are one category of natural law. They seem to be the laws that govern what we call inanimate matter. Even though I was arguing that actually probably it's not inanimate, it might be better to think of it as alive, as of the nature of consciousness, crystallized consciousness turned to form. But the laws of physics govern one set of laws. Now, physics would like to believe that they are the most fundamental laws, that if you can reduce everything to one set of laws, they would be the laws of atoms and energy and particles and space and time. That physicists would like to believe that that's the most fundamental truth and that everything comes from that. I don't think it's so straightforward, actually. I don't think it's as straightforward as that. And maybe that will, you'll see why. So yes, the first category of laws covers inanimate matter, the fact that apples fall to the ground, the fact that the earth revolves around the sun. Physics can explain those phenomena pretty well. Not perfectly. Physicists still use models, and those models are imperfect. They don't fit. So relativity, the theory of Einstein's theory of relativity, general relativity, doesn't fit with the theory of quantum physics. Quantum physics tells you something about what matter is at the smallest levels. Relativity tells you something about what space and time are at the most cosmic levels. And the two theories are incompatible. So one or both of them are wrong. Yeah? Probably both. They're models, and none of the models is able to embrace the whole picture, even just when you're talking about matter and space and time. Let alone if you were to introduce the notion of conscious beings into the picture, then physics doesn't stand a chance, at least as it's currently set up. Because currently, physicists don't view consciousness as anything more than arising a phenomena that arises out of your brain. Yeah, they you get all sorts of paradoxes in quantum physics because matter seems to be inherently linked with consciousness. So what I'm trying to say is that even at that fundamental level of the laws of physics, we don't know what's going on, but we have some models. And there does seem to be some predictable patterns to how phenomena unfold. But then, you know, evolution has taken matter, and at least from one perspective, what's happened is that life has emerged in the universe, on Earth at least, and maybe elsewhere. There's what we call biological life, biological forms. We don't know what that is, but then remember, we don't know what matter was either. Yeah, so we're still in the dark, but just from a descriptive perspective, you can say, okay, when matter seems to get complex enough, new behaviors seem to arise, new behaviors seem to be displayed, and they are better described by biological laws, biological processes, than by studying atoms. The laws of physics don't seem to be that suited to describe things like cellular reproduction or photosynthesis or the digestive system in human beings. You need sort of biological laws. I'm using the word laws in that way of talking about models. But it does seem that botany and biology and zoology come up with their own models and language to describe these complex, more complex structures. And then as life becomes, so that's a second category of nearma. And then as life becomes more complex, we seem to get the emergence of consciousness, of mind. Now, again, this is just a model, because earlier I was talking about mind as perhaps being primary and everything being alive. But nevertheless, I think most people would agree that you get animal life that seems to be conscious. I guess some people might still dispute that, but I don't know how else to talk about animals apart from assuming that they share some degree of consciousness with human beings, with us. So you do seem to, once animal life has emerged, get new sorts of behaviour, which can perhaps be best described as mind and laws of consciousness. So, for example, geese migrating in the winter, that's an instinct, an animal instinct. And again, you might best describe that in terms of consciousness, rather than just using the laws of physics to describe that. Laws of physics don't seem to work. Einstein once said, "It won't do. How can the laws of physics and biology describe or explain a phenomenon as miraculous as first love?" So Einstein had a sort of poet's heart, and he, as one of the most wonderful minds of the 20th century, wasn't trying to reduce everything to the laws of physics. Yeah? Something else is also going on. So far I've talked about three kind of categories: the physical world and its laws, the biological kind of laws that govern life, and then when consciousness starts to emerge, sort of laws of mind, of consciousness. But Buddhism says that in a way those three categories are, well, they're inevitable. We all have we're all governed by those laws, but in a certain sense they are not under our control, or at least we can't really influence them very much. If I trip up, I will fall to the ground. I'm not going to take off in the air, even if I were an enlightened being. Even the Buddha was subject to the laws of physics and the biological laws of his body when he had a body. He couldn't escape those laws, yeah? At least while he had a body. What the Buddha taught, though, is that there's another set of laws, that we can really use intelligently or not. And this other set of laws starts to operate when, not only when there's consciousness, but when there's self-consciousness. So self-consciousness is this phenomena where, as a person, as a being, we not only are aware, but we're aware that we're aware. We can refer to ourselves, talk about ourselves, think about ourselves, and potentially change ourselves through that self-awareness. As soon as there's self-awareness, which seems to have evolved in at least human beings, maybe it's there in other animals too, but in human beings it seems to be pretty developed. As soon as there's self-awareness, another set of laws starts to operate, which is the law of karma. The law of karma. So I'm going to pause and just see if one of you wants to say what the law of karma is, what the Buddha meant by the law of karma. It's a very kind of common term now, in even in our culture. So what notion do you have of the law of karma? Because it's critical to understanding the Buddha's teaching, this law of karma. Any suggestions?
Actions have consequences.
Yes, actions have consequences. So can you say a little bit more about what sort of actions and what sort of consequences?
I can leave that to you.
You'll leave that to me, all right. After all, I'm giving a talk, so... anybody else wants to have a go at... Because that's a good, true statement about the law of karma, but there's even more that we can say. Actions have consequences, but what sort of actions, what sort of consequences? Because some actions might not have karmic consequences. So the law of karma isn't talking about all actions. It's talking about conscious willed action. It's some actions might be unconscious, instinctive, and not have any will behind them, a volition. But other actions are definitely conscious willed actions. We know that we're doing something because we want to do this thing. Does that make sense? That we will certain actions. There's conscious volitions behind our actions. Many of our actions we talk about my will, what I want, all our volitions, that wanting, be it wanting something very basic like cake. I'm hoping there's still cake out there when we go out from this talk, to I don't know, wanting love, wanting fulfillment, wanting happiness, all those sort of existential yearnings that we might have as human beings, wanting material well-being and comfort, all of those things. All those wantings that we have lead us to act in certain ways. And every time we act from a conscious volition, there are consequences. There are consequences. And those consequences, that relationship between willed action and consequence, is described in by this law, the law of karma. So I'm going to say a little bit more about it, see if we can sort of take it a bit further. So the reason that this is important is because with this law of karma, what we're talking about is choice, is our ability to choose whether we act in one way or in another. Human beings have that choice because we've got self-consciousness. If we didn't have self-consciousness, you could say we'd be driven just by our instincts. There'd be no free kind of choice. But because we've got choice, we can act in a way that is going to make us freer, happier, more fulfilled, or we can act in a way that's going to lead to more pain and suffering. And the law of karma says that if we act from certain volitions, they will have positive consequences. The consequences will be positive for ourselves and the world around us, others around us. And other volitions will lead to more painful consequences. Now, the volition is key. The volition is key. So the motivation behind our action is going to be a key factor in deciding whether the consequences are painful or pleasant or positive or less positive. So what sort of volitions do you think are likely to lead to positive actions?
Well,
positive consequences. What's, say that again?
Positive thoughts.
Positive thoughts, yep. So what would you, you're right, so what would you mean by positive in that sense? Yeah, but then that's a bit circular.
Yeah, it's...
So, I mean, can you give me an example then of a positive thought? Give me an example.
Helping somebody.
Yeah. So I think you've sort of nailed it really. What it is if a volition is generous, kind, altruistic, other regarding, coming from an awareness of the situation, including an awareness of somebody else, then the likelihood is that the actions that stem from that sort of positive volition will have positive consequences. Yeah. Now, you can still make mistakes. So part of the law of karma is that you also need, as well as kindness and generosity in the mix and altruism, you also need awareness. You need some wisdom in the mix. Because you can cause dreadful things to happen through kindly motivations. So the law of karma also includes awareness in this mix. And one of the first consequences of our volitional actions is on our own minds. So I'm going to say something and see if this rings true. The law of karma says that when we act with positive volitions like generosity and kindness and love and awareness, that our minds become more expansive, fulfilled, brighter, creative, more connected. Does that ring true? That we feel bigger. Our minds have more spaciousness to them. They have more of a sense of being connected with the world around us. There's more meaning in our lives when we act with those sorts of volitions. Conversely, when we act from, as we all probably do, from more self-centered, selfish volitions, like, I don't know, just grabbing what's there for me, that last piece of plum tart is what's on my mind, as well as perhaps even more harmful volitions like hatred and cruelty. When we act from those states, the consequences on our mind are that we shrink. The consciousness that we have seems to become smaller, more rigid, less creative, darker. I mean, they're all metaphors for states of mind. But it's as if we fragment our world. We split off from other people. We feel more separate. We feel more defensive and fearful and smaller. Does that make sense as well? You know, a life lived from hatred would lead to a mind that was very fearful and defended and small and brittle and probably unhappy. So the first consequence of the law of karma is on our own minds. That's what the law of karma is firstly getting at. It's saying that our volitional actions have a consequence on our own minds. And then, of course, we have consequences out there in the world that can also be beneficial or harmful. So this is the basis of Buddhist ethics. This is the basis of what the Buddha taught in terms of working on our behaviours. We need to, in a way, look at our actions, particularly in relation to other people, and judge them by what is the volition behind them. Am I trying to help, or am I trying to just grab what I want? Yeah. And because there's choice, we can start to choose more beneficial actions. Meditation helps you by bringing more awareness and more choice into your mind. Sometimes we're not really aware of what our volitions are. We're acting without real awareness of what's going on. Meditation is a path to greater self-awareness, which then leads to greater choice. Yeah. So let me just pause there. Does that make sense? So far we've talked about these four categories. We've got laws that are operating just at a physical level, then a biological level, then a sort of instinctive mind level. And now we're talking about laws that operate at self-conscious, when there's self-consciousness and will. But that's not enough. What Buddhism says is that, in a way, that's still not going to lead you to enlightenment. It's not going to lead you to liberation. Won't lead to complete freedom from, well, transcendence of pain, of suffering. We're still trapped in this delusion that there's a real me and a real world. And no matter how kind or generous that real me, that me is, if there's still the delusion that there's a me, a real fixed separate entity called me in a real world, then there isn't real wisdom. So the Buddhist path is about also trying to see through that delusion. Trying to see through that delusion. And it's said that when you do see through that delusion, not only is there an expansion of consciousness, but a new set of laws starts to come into place. And it's a set of laws that carry on leading you to more and more expansive states, more and more liberated states. There's a momentum that seems to be put in train, which leads you from this deluded, fixed way of being all the way to Buddhahood, to enlightenment. And it's said that that momentum can last over lifetimes. That it might be that, you know, you've already been somewhere in a previous life, been practicing. And it might be that you'll carry on practicing in the lifetime to come. This momentum is seen in Buddhist terms to span more than this lifetime. So then it becomes a sort of quest over lifetimes to see through this delusion completely. To completely transcend the limitations that this delusion imposes on our minds. The idea is that if we could completely transcend this delusion, that what would be, as it were, liberated is not just an expanded mind, but a force of love, that there would be an energy of love that was released when we realize that we're not really as separate as we think we are, that separateness is part of the delusion. That at the level, at the fundamental level of mind, consciousness isn't bounded. It's not bounded by our skulls, by our bodies. Consciousness somehow is always beyond limitations of space and time. And knowing that, experiencing that, what's said to be released is a love that is impartial, universal, that transcends all boundaries. The Buddhist project is about realizing that for ourselves, and not only just for ourselves for the sake of it, but then starting to, with others, be a force for good in the world. Because the world, it's no good just us liberating ourselves from our personal suffering. If there's really no separateness, then as long as there's suffering anywhere in the world, that's part of the project. That's part of the project. So the Buddhist vision is to be together a force for good in the world. And it feels to me like the world needs something of that vision. It's the loftiest vision that I've ever encountered. What's for me particularly captivating is that it's not, as it were, a supernatural vision. I know I've mentioned lifetimes and things, but even if you don't believe in rebirth, this vision makes sense in this life. To try and transcend our self-centeredness, to experience greater degree of connectedness with all life and the natural world around us, to participate in this flow of love so that we can be a force for good in the world, helping to alleviate suffering, to feel that that is a natural law, not just some sort of superimposed good idea. That feels to me a very, very necessary, essential project to be engaged in. It feels to me the most important thing that we could be doing with our lives. Everything else is, to me, feels secondary. What else is there to do? We're alive. That's a fact. What are we going to do with that? I also believe that because it's a natural law, it's not that Buddhism has a monopoly on this. Buddhism doesn't have a monopoly on the law of karma or on self-transcendence. It's a natural law. Consciousness, human consciousness, wants to expand beyond the limits of self-centeredness. And when we do experience moments of self-transcendence, of self-forgetting in a positive sense, we also experience ourselves as more alive. I don't know if you can relate to this, but it's very, very normal for people to have heightened experiences that are very significant, sometimes in nature, sometimes connected with beauty, sometimes connected with somebody that you love, sometimes actually in crisis and in trauma, even crisis like bereavement, can bring to life for perhaps a short period of time an experience where we go beyond our normal consciousness. We experience something much, much more meaningful. And Buddhism saying that that's not an accident, that's part of the natural law of consciousness. It wants to expand. We keep it small. We keep it sort of imprisoned by this delusion that there's a real me and a real world. So we can systematically undo that delusion. Firstly, by using the law of karma and loosening the bonds of our self-centeredness. Then meditation will help to increase awareness and make the mind more pliable. And then finally, there's this working at a wisdom level to undo the root delusion so that it's not just undone at a cognitive level, but right in the depths of our hearts, we realize the truth of this non-separateness. So I'm going to finish some words from Carl Sagan again, and then maybe if I've got time I'll read you something else. Carl Sagan said, "For as long as there have been humans, we have searched for our place in the cosmos. Where are we? Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. This perspective is a courageous continuation of our penchant for constructing and testing mental models of the skies, the sun as a red-hot stone, the stars as a celestial flame, the galaxy as the backbone of night. If we long for our planet to be important, there is something we can do about it. We make our world significant by the courage of our questions and by the depth of our answers. Again, Carl Sagan is putting us right at the heart of this cosmic adventure by saying that we have a choice. The courage of our questions and the depth of our answers. What are we going to do with our lives? What are we really going to do with the fact that we're conscious, living beings that can make some sort of difference, even if it seems a small difference? And Buddhism, I think, is saying that difference that we can make is perhaps bigger than we've dared to imagine because of natural laws governing consciousness. So yes, I have got a few minutes. So I'm going to read you something that doesn't come from a Buddhist. It comes from David Foster Wallace, who was a writer, an American writer, who died tragically young not that many years ago. And David Foster Wallace is urging us to really use the time that we've got to really look at the nature of experience through the choices that we make. So he says, and it's quite a long passage this, so you just have to bear with me. He says, because here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Christ or Allah, Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess, or the Four Noble Truths, or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we know all this. It's been codified as myths, bromides, proverbs, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power and you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep that fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they are evil or sinful, it is that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms, alone and at the centre of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it, but of course there are all different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious, you will not hear much talked about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.